All right. Okay. So we're live. It's always interesting trying to figure out when exactly this thing goes live. But welcome to the seminar, the webinar on how to improve your biological power. Welcome to my office. I'm not doing any exercise demos in this webinar, so I figured I could just stay here in my office and do it in here. So, anyways, I see I've got several people online live with me, and so if you guys have any questions or anything like that, as we're going through the presentation, you can submit them there through the little chat thing, little chat bar there you see on the right-hand side, and I'll get to them. And I'm going to do some, basically what I'm going to do is do a little PowerPoint presentation explaining, what is biological power, why is it important for you to understand what it is, and how it's going to help you improve your training program. And so it's really kind of a matter of learning the right focal points for your training program. There is no magic, formula. There, sets and reps and exercises and stuff like that. Obviously, there's some combinations that work better than others. But if you understand the right thought process to apply to your training, then one, it'll help you make better training decisions, and two, it will help you figure out kind of how to make better use of whatever it is that you are doing, so whatever program you're following. So that's kind of my goal today. So like I said, I'm gonna do a little PowerPoint presentation. I do have the PowerPoint slides figured out this time, so hopefully you guys will actually be able to see the slides cycle through instead of just staring at one like has happened sometimes in the past. I am relatively new to this webinar stuff, getting better though, but have some snafus every once in a while. So I'm gonna go through that, and then I'll open it up to Q&A at the end. I've got some practical suggestions that you guys can start implementing to help improve your biological power. And one, just kind of, that's one, and two, understanding how to use your brain to improve all that. So nice. Already got some people coming in. Nick says, "Hey James, what's up, Nick? Glad you made it on, man." Mike, thanks for doing the webinar. All my webinars that I do, I'm gonna have online for people to be able to watch again. So one, you'll get if you've registered and you're online with me now, or even if you just registered, you'll get the replay link emailed to you a couple hours after it's posted. And but yeah, I always try to make these things available because I know not everybody can watch them live, and also you might miss something or want to go back and review it. So so cool. So as I answer the questions, I am going to erase them or whatever, so I can keep an eye on new ones popping in. So all right, so without further ado, we're going to get into the PowerPoints, and I'm going to explain what biological power is and how you can improve it. Like I said, I'll get into some questions there at the end. And all right, so just give me a second to get the PowerPoint pulled up. Here we go. All right, press the right button here. Excellent. Okay, so improving your biological power. And I subtitled this thing "Hacking into Your Brain and Body to Maximize Your Results." Everybody likes a good hack these days, and so I'm going to show you some biopower hacks. And all hacking is really is getting into, like, it's the 80-20 rule, right? It's 80% of your results come from about 20% of the things you can do. So if you can figure out what that 20% that gives you the biggest that accounts for most of your results, and how to focus on that, that's all kind of hacking into this stuff is. And then that's what I'm gonna try to give you guys an idea of. So what this comes around, what biological power, why I brought this up is this question right here. What is endurance? And this is a big question. This is one that's on the top of pretty much every mountain biker's mind, is how do I improve my endurance? I want to be able to ride, longer, faster, just be able to, not fatigue as fast toward the end of a ride. Whatever it is, 9 times out of 10, it comes down to some sort of endurance question. And so, it's important to understand what is endurance. Now, I'll tell you right off the bat, endurance is not cardio training. And this is an unfortunate thing, is that endurance training and cardio training have become synonymous. But we really kind of need to separate the two terms, because cardio training is a part of your endurance, but it's not endurance training in and of itself. Endurance is specific to the sport and event. So you have to look at, the athlete and the specifics of their event. Now, this seems to make sense on the surface, but there's some very obvious examples here, like sprinters versus marathon runners. So if you have great endurance for sprinting, you're not necessarily going to have great endurance for marathon, and vice versa. Olympic weightlifter versus a CrossFit athlete. A CrossFit athlete tends to do higher rep stuff, higher volume stuff, whereas an Olympic weightlifter is a lower volume, higher intensity stuff. And so understanding the differences there. But then getting, into our own sport, enduro racing versus cross country racing versus downhill racing versus just trail riding versus road riding, all of these things, the endurance is specific to the event that you're doing. And so everyone's probably nodding their head right now, going like, "Yeah, James, it's pretty obvious, duh." But again, we have a disconnect oftentimes in how our training programs are set up versus what we're doing on the trail. And probably the biggest example of this is how many people follow a road rider based, a program that's set up for road riding, and use that as a way to train for mountain biking, or just using road biking as a way to train for mountain biking. So the endurance for those two sports is very different. And so hopefully I can help highlight some of those things and give you guys some ideas through hearing the thing here, hearing the webinar. So to accomplish endurance, to accomplish this, your body has to create what's known as biological power. And I've kind of shortened it to biopower, but it's the interplay between four systems that your body uses to create and utilize energy. And so the energy, the endurance equation, it's got two sides. It's got both, output, how much energy can you create, how much power can you create, and then you also have how efficiently do you utilize that energy. And so if we're thinking about a car analogy, you're looking at either increasing the size of the gas tank, or you're looking at increasing the efficiency, the miles per gallon that you're able to get out of that gas tank. And so understanding how to attack both sides of that is really important, because oftentimes we're just focusing on one aspect of it, which is trying to build a bigger gas tank. And a lot of times that's done in the absence of any sort of attempts to improve the real efficiency of how your body uses that energy. And sometimes it actually like starts to work against how efficient your body can use energy. And so what are these four systems? Now, these are not listed in order of importance. So when I say system number one, this does not mean that the cardiovascular system is the number one most important system. This is just the first system. Now, it may be the most important. This is the thing, like, there is no most important system. All of these things are connected. And so, you're going to have different weak links within these systems as you progress. And so there's going to be points in time where your cardiovascular system may be the most important thing for you to focus on. It may be the weak link, but it may not be. And if you don't know what these other systems are, and you don't know how to kind of think about improving them, then you get kind of stuck. There's an old saying that when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so there's a lot of people out there that cardio training is the only hammer that they have in their toolbox. And so everything that pops up looks like a nail to them, no matter what you want to improve or work on. The answer is always do more cardio, or do some sort of different cardio, but it always comes back to cardio training as the answer. And so what I'm trying to do is give you guys some different tools for your toolbox, so you're not just using a hammer for everything. Sometimes you need a screwdriver or something. But the cardiovascular system is your heart, lungs, and veins' ability to deliver oxygen and fuel to the muscles, and to take away metabolic byproducts. Now, obviously, this is a very high-level view of this stuff, all right? So there's a lot more things that the cardiovascular system does, and I'm not trying to get into a lot of different specifics. I'm just taking a big overview of what these systems do. And so, again, this is one that most people are pretty familiar with, and so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on it. But yeah, just how well can you deliver what your muscles need to work, and then how well can you get rid of the metabolic byproducts that are created from that work? System number two is the metabolic system. Now, these are the chemical reactions used to create energy. So again, once your cardiovascular system has delivered oxygen and fuel to the muscles, or the muscles have freed up fuel and have it available to work, then they need to be able to then utilize that. And so you have enzymes and substrates and things that your body uses to attach and create these chemical reactions with these, with the oxygen and with the different fuel sources that your body provides. And so, excuse me, you need to be able to utilize the fuel that your body is providing. Now, beyond this, the metabolic system, you're also looking at different types of energy systems. So this is where things like aerobic versus anaerobic come in, because the enzymes and substrates and all that stuff that you need to create energy for aerobic metabolism is different than the ones that you need for anaerobic metabolism. And so, again, if you don't understand the specifics of that and how it kind of applies to what you're doing. So it's not just enough to do cardio training. You also have to think about the metabolic environment that you're creating. And, is it what you're wanting to create as it relates to what you're doing on the trail? So system number three is the hormonal system. So hormones, again, very simplified look at what they do, but they basically are the signal callers. They signal the cells in the body on how to act. And so without spoiling it too much, I'm going to get into this here in just a second, but ultimately this is how your brain controls a lot of what goes on in your body. Is it tells different glands and to release these hormones, and these hormones then signal specific cells in the body and on what to do. And so the hormones can be either, there's two general things. You've got anabolic, which is kind of rest and restore, where your body's, in relax and rebuild mode. And then you've got catabolic, which is where you're breaking things down. And this is kind of fight or flight mode and kind of where your body's, again, it's just kind of that opposite there. This is like sympathetic versus parasympathetic nervous system and stuff like that. A lot of this ties into that. And so your hormones have a big, a big impact on this, releasing insulin and cortisol and testosterone and adrenaline and, all of these different hormones into the body have very specific effects on how your body reacts to what's going on. And so again, just kind of understanding how the hormones work, and that's one of the systems your body uses, can help. So system number four, and this one's actually to me one of the most interesting ones, because there's a lot of stuff you can do with the neuromuscular system and how your body learns to create more efficient movement. And so your neuromuscular system basically controls the muscles through the nervous system. Your muscles are dumb, and they get electrical signals, sent to them through the nervous signal or through the nervous system that tell them to contract and how hard to contract and how fast to contract and which muscles to contract and which ones to not contract. And so a lot of what you want to do from an improvement on an efficiency side is improve that neuromuscular system. The more efficient your neuromuscular system is at creating movement, the less of an energy cost that movement is going to have. And so, again, that's just a real important thing to keep in mind, because if you're working your tail off, working on your ability to produce power, but you're doing it in a way that's actually like not very efficient, and you're not focusing on efficient movement, and you're actually working against yourself. Like, one of the reasons you have to work so hard is because you work so inefficiently that you have to make up for that. So again, just making sure that you're keeping that in mind. So what does this mean? Everything is related to everything else, and you can't separate them. And this is the number one reason people don't see results from their program, at least in my experience of doing this for, well over 10 years now. The number one reason that I see people don't see results is they don't understand the interplay of these four systems and how they relate, and how you have to, have these things thought about and present in your training program. Because, your cardiovascular system is going to affect the hormonal system, and that's going to affect the metabolic system, and all of these things affect each other. So you can't improve one without it impacting the others, and you can't have one, detrain and fall apart without it affecting the other ones. And so this is why having great cardiovascular, good cardiovascular system, but a poor neuromuscular system, just move very inefficiently, that's not the ultimate goal. And so you're actually working against yourself when you're doing that. So kind of understanding how these things can relate to each other, and how you can make sure that you're focusing on what you need as a rider with your program, versus just kind of arbitrarily throwing one or two things together and, hoping like, okay, well, this cardio training program is what I need, when it's like, well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but there's other things you need to be keeping in mind too, while you're doing that. So, hold on a second. All right, excuse me. Had to get a drink there. All right, so here we go. This is the exciting stuff. Brain controls all. The reason for this is that the brain controls all. Your brain is constantly monitoring and learning from the internal and external environment. And so I shot a short little video and posted it online the other day, or I think it was yesterday, and basically pointing out and asking the question, like, can you train your brain like a dog? And there was a good book by Malcolm Gladwell put out several years ago called What the Dog Saw. And the basic premise is that, it doesn't matter what you think that the dog saw. All it matters is what the dog saw. And the dog learns from what it sees, not from what you think that it sees. And so your brain is like that dog, and that it is constantly monitoring and learning. And it doesn't matter what you think that it sees. It only matters what it really saw. And if there's, a disconnect there, you start to run into problems. Because your brain, ultimately, it wants to predict what is going to happen and how to react. So this is one of the reasons that as athletes practice their sport more, they get better and more efficient at the sport, because the brain starts to learn what's happening, and it starts to be able to predict what's going to happen and how it wants to react. That takes less mental energy and less overall energy to do that than it does to have to, look at every situation as some unique stimulus and learn from scratch how to act and what to do in this situation. So, the more that you ride your bike, the more your body is able to predict what's going to happen and how to react to riding your bike and the different situations that that happen on your bike. Now, the difference between what your brain expects and what actually happens will negatively impact performance. Now, this all ties back to what I was talking about with the four systems and understanding the interplay between them, because your brain is ultimately monitoring and using all of these four systems. And if you're doing things in training that are different than what your body is going to experience on the trail, or you don't have your training set up in a way that emphasizes experiences that your body is going to, have on the trail, then you're going to have a disconnect. This, again, just a real simple analogy. This is one of the main reasons that riders that spend a good chunk of their time on road bikes in the off season doing their training don't feel like they get as much of a transfer, at least not right off the bat, from from that training to the trail. There's a trans, period where they get up back on their mountain bikes and back on the trail, and they have to quote unquote kind of ride themselves into trail shape, and feel that, man, why, all that work that I put in it, I should feel better for this. I mean, this is a common occurrence. I hear this all the time from people. They're like, man, all those hours I put in on a road bike over the off season just really didn't seem to transfer over to the trail like I thought that it would. And it's because your brain learned, you spent months training your brain what to expect and how to react to riding a road bike, which is a different position, different weights, all of these different things. And then all of a sudden, when you get on the trail, there's a huge difference between what it has learned to expect and what is actually happening. And so, that's a big example there. But again, you run into this problem with cross-country riders that go out for 4-hour rides and call that training. Your body learns to pace itself. When it expects a 4-hour ride, it paces itself for a 4-hour ride. And so if you're not, like, training yourself in a way to have your brain learn to expect what is actually going to happen on the trail, it's going to impact negatively impact performance. So this means that setting up your training with the internal and external environment in mind is very important. So internal, we're talking about positions, movements that you're using. You're talking about tension levels that you need. You're talking about the metabolic system, the energy system's demands of powering that movement. And then the external environment, again, I touched on it a little bit as far as like the difference between riding on a road bike and riding on a mountain bike, completely different external environment. Again, we look at it and we're like, it's a bike. It's the same thing. But from your brain's perspective, the way that it monitors everything, that's a different external environment. And so it starts to adapt to that different external environment. And so, again, this is one of the reasons that people who, if you're born in an area, and obviously there are some other things that go into this, but there's a reason that great downhillers tend to come from areas that have mountains and lots of downhilling opportunities. You can't simulate some of those things outside of the sport itself. So anyways, I can go off on that. So let's get into some biopower hacks here. So biological power hacks, these are ways to maximize your training program. And again, this isn't necessarily specific sets, reps, and exercises or some sort of formula. These are focal points that you can have that will help you make better training decisions and to help you get more out of whatever training program you're following. Now, obviously, I'm biased and I think that I have some pretty good training programs and I think that some programs are better than others. But a bad program with great focus and good intensity as far as like working, just consistency, I guess. A bad program with good focus and consistency will trump the best program in the world that doesn't have any real focus, where the athlete doesn't have any real focus or consistency. And so these are those focal points. The consistency is up to you. The focal points are up to you. The program, hopefully you find a good one to help you out with that. So let's get into them. So number one, use strength training to learn how efficient movement feels, feet, hips, and shoulders. So this is probably the number one, again, efficiency is a huge thing. It's a huge, huge, huge aspect of your biological power. How efficiently you use energy becomes like one of the most, if not the most important factor for athletes, especially the longer they get in their career. No one's VO2 max improves forever. In fact, you'll see athletes that have their VO2 doesn't get any better. And in some cases, the VO2 max has actually decreased a little bit as they got older. And yet their performance continued to improve. So the reason for this is that the efficiency of their movement became better. Again, it touches back on the more you ride your bike, just the more efficient you're going to be at that. If you're a runner, you want to run. It's like your sport. One of the things is people forget, like, when I was a track athlete, I didn't run to improve my anaerobic threshold. I ran to get better at running. Now my anaerobic threshold improved or whatever improved as a result of, X number of sprints and blah, blah, blah. But that wasn't the reason I ran. The reason I ran was to get better at running. And so how you move, you want to, do things that help you get better at moving the way you want to move in your sport. And good movement has a specific feel. So feet, good movement is going to be balanced on the feet. Again, we're very rarely are you going to be up on the balls of your feet. There's no sport out there that asks you to actually like just stay on the balls of your feet all the time, except for cycling for some reason. Again, none of the other sports are on the balls of their feet all the time. Actually having a balanced foot position is extremely important in every sport, including ours, whether we realize it or not. But you want to be balanced on the feet. You want to have, weight on the back of your foot or on your heel. You want to have weight on the ball of your foot, maybe about 60% on your heel, 40% on the ball of your foot. But you want to make sure that you're balanced and you have weight, your weight distributed and balanced on your foot. And your hips, you want to make sure that you're feeling the tension in the glutes and hamstrings. You don't want to be feeling tension in the lower back. You don't want to be feeling tension and too much tension in the quads and it doesn't want to feel like a hamstring stretch. Like there's your glutes and your hamstrings up there at the hips where they meet. That's where you should be feeling tension and stuff. And again, this stuff applies whether you're doing a deadlift or you're doing a squat or you're holding a plank. You know, obviously the feet thing will change a little bit, but these movement principles of how things should feel apply to all of this stuff. Now, how you apply the feeling that the specific print, you know, the specific methods that you use to move may change, but these principles don't. And so, again, so, you know, we touched on the hips and then the shoulders. This is a big one for us that we don't pay enough attention to. And, you know, you see people with great planks, right? They got the cores looking awesome, but their shoulders are just rounded and hunched up and shoulder blades winged out. And that's, you know, terrible shoulder position. So you have to pay attention and think about your shoulders. And what you want to make sure that you have is you want to tuck your shoulder blades into your back pockets. Think, you know, long collarbones, wide shoulders. It's not pinch your shoulder blades together, because if all you do is pinch your shoulder blades together, if you have like really rounded shoulders, then yes, that'll help pull it back. But you want to think about tucking your shoulder blades into your back pockets more, because eventually if you just keep, you know, pinching your shoulder blades together, you're going to go too far in the other direction. We don't want that. We want shoulder blades tucked in the back pockets, wide collarbones, wide shoulders, you know, and so that's the basic feelings that you're after. And now if you use your strength training to focus on those feelings, so it doesn't matter whether you're doing one of my programs, whether you're doing CrossFit, whether you're doing, you know, a local program with, you know, one of your local trainers or coaches or whatever, it doesn't matter what it is. If you realize that strength training is movement practice, don't get hung up on the external numbers. Use strength training as movement practice to learn how good, efficient movement feels. It's going to transfer over so much better to the bike, because now you're going to be able to transfer that feeling over to the bike. So that's how you kind of hack your movement, I guess. You know, you can speed up your learning curve on efficient movement by using strength training as a form of movement practice to learn how efficient movement feels. And then using the, you know, using those lessons and applying them on the bike, you know, balanced feet, feeling the tension in the hips and not too much in the quads and the low back. And, you know, making sure that you're keeping your shoulder blades tucked and, you know, the lats engaged, tension in the upper back. You know, you want to feel your, you know, your upper back should be tight and have some tension. You don't want to have tension in the shoulders and the chest as much as you want in that upper back. And so all of those movement lessons, you know, flip over and apply to the bike. And that's really going to help you from that neuromuscular system efficiency standpoint to get more efficient with your movement. So number two, use your mountain bike for on-bike cardio training and train standing pedaling separately. So these are kind of two things. The first one I've touched on several times, you know, you need to ride your mountain bike. Inefficiency training is one of the best ways to improve your cardio, right? You need to challenge yourself in some way that makes your cardiovascular system have to work a little harder than what it's used to doing. And so inefficiency training is one of the best ways to do that. And so when you think about it that way, you realize, well, you know, going from my mountain bike to a lightweight, you know, stiff bike that's more efficient than my mountain bike is actually not beneficial for my cardio training. That sticking with your mountain bike, or better yet, doing things to make it more inefficient, like a little bit heavier tires. This is one of the reasons, again, that I like to use flats in the off season. You don't pedal less efficiently with flats, but there is a little bit less efficient transfer of power from the foot into the pedal. And you also have to force yourself to pedal in the most efficient manner possible, because when your feet are attached to the pedals, anything that you do, any way that you pedal will, you know, get the cranks going. And some people look at that as a positive, but that's not a positive. Your brain isn't forced to learn the most efficient way to pedal that way. Excuse me. And so using flats in the off season to, you know, force your body to use and learn the most efficient pedal stroke is going to, you know, help your riding overall and your cardio overall. So if you go back to the clipless pedals, it's actually going to help you get more out of them doing that. And so, you know, mountain bike, stick with your mountain bike. If there's ways that you can, you know, if you have a heavier bike or something, like a more inefficient mountain bike is actually a better thing to ride in the off season. Like, you know, if you come off of like a heavy, you know, bike and you come on back onto your race bike at the beginning of the season, you have like the opposite effect of what most people experience coming from a super efficient road bike to their mountain bike. Instead of feeling like, oh man, I got to get used to this again, you're like, oh dude, this is great. It's like someone freaking took the boat anchor off the back of my bike. I'm on fire now, you know? So use your mountain bike, look for ways that you can make the mountain bike actually maybe a little bit less efficient in the off season to force your cardiovascular system to work a little bit hard. And then two, you need to understand that standing pedaling is a separate training thing. You have to train it separately. Seated pedaling does not carry over to standing pedaling. Again, if you're looking at this from a neuromuscular standpoint, seated pedaling and standing pedaling are two completely different things. Your muscles, your position, you know, all of those things are being utilized in a completely different way. And so you're, from the brain's perspective, it needs a lot of time. The more often that you're able to present it with that situation and that environment, the more learning opportunities that it gets and the more efficient that it's going to get from those learning opportunities. And so I like to have people focus a lot of their on-bike cardio training in the off season on standing pedaling, especially if you feel like that is a weakness of yours. If you feel like you're not a strong standing pedaler, then it should be something that you focus on with your on-bike cardio stuff. So make sure you're thinking about that. So number three, and this breaks down to or comes down to understanding how to vary the intensity of your rides each week. And every ride can't be hard, because if they're all hard, then none of them are hard. Hard is in relation to something else. And so if they're all quote unquote hard, they're really just kind of moderate. You just don't realize it because you don't have anything else to compare it to. So you need to have hard rides and less hard rides, I guess would be the technical term. So you want to do 1 to 2 hard or race pace rides each week. So if you race, you want to be doing things that simulate race pace. So again, if you are a cross-country racer and your average race takes, you know, less than 2 hours, then that does not mean going out for a four-hour ride. That is not a race pace ride, because there's no way you can maintain the pace that you use during a, you know, hour and a half to 2 hour ride for 4 hours. And so, you know, going on rides that are around that length, you know, maybe a little shorter if you need to get faster, maybe a little bit longer if you need to improve your endurance. But the rule of thumb is, you know, plus or minus 10% of the length of the race is about where you want to get for under distance and over distance training. Like once you start getting too far outside that plus or minus 10%, then you start to train for something different than that actual, the specific energy systems demands of that sport. And so, you know, if you're a downhill guy, either doing downhill runs, but again, just cranking out downhill runs at the local downhill park is not race pace rides. That's not, you know, race pace rides are probably doing 3 to 5 hard, high focus rides and taking quite a bit of time in between each ride, because again, you're trying to simulate what happens at a race. So if you're always going and you're never getting your body used to the demands of riding hard and then having to sit around and wait for a while and then getting to do it again, you know, whether you're waiting in line to do your warm-ups or your practice runs or whatever it is, you know, that there's just, if you think about race day on for downhill racing and then just try to think, all right, I got to train my body to get used to this. And so same thing with enduro racing. You know, think about what does an enduro race entail. And this is a little bit harder because enduro races tend to be like longer all-day events, and not everyone has the ability to do that. But if you think about it, it is short bursts of high-intensity riding coupled with long periods of active rest is what it should be. So low-intensity, more active rest. So again, if you're going out for a two to four-hour ride, and you're just going like at a constant pace the whole time, again, that's not a race pace ride for enduro. Enduro race pace rides would be pin it for 5-10 minutes. Like again, you have to think about what is your races look like. You know, local different race series have different lengths of time and stuff like that. So you got to look at that. And again, there may be some that are short, some that are long, but you got to kind of just take the average into account. And your goal is to go out and, you know, look at pushing yourself hard for that period of time and then backing way off and taking it really easy for a period of time. And that's kind of the hard part. I think a lot of enduro racers screw themselves by going too hard during the transfer stages. They have not trained themselves to go super easy and use the transfer stages as a true active recovery, and end up using too much metabolic or, you know, biological power really to get themselves from stage to stage. And so, you know, again, thinking about how your race demands are like that, those are race paced rides. All right. So doing one to two of those a week, coupled with one to three skills focused rides each week. And this is where you're going out and you're not worried about how fast you're going. You're just worried about riding efficiently. You're just, excuse me, looking to be smooth, looking to, you know, carry momentum well. You can have specific skills picked out if you're working on cornering or you're working on, you know, unweighting your front end, you know, body position, vision, whatever it is. You may have a specific thing picked out, but the thing is this ride is not about going hard. All right. You're not trying to get any KOMs or anything like that. It's about going like, you know, about 80%. You're just looking at about going 80% effort level for wherever you are that day, and just focus on riding your skills. I kind of play a little game called see who pedals the least. And, you know, it's almost like, you know, I pretend that I'm going to get penalized for every pedal stroke that I take. And so I really got to work on not relying on pedaling to get me through everything, and to work on good technique, carrying my momentum, you know, vision. So I'm anticipating what's coming ahead, all of those things. And so you're getting your hard rides in, and you're getting your moderate rides in, focusing on the skill. And so again, this is allowing you to focus on the two ends of the spectrum, both the ability to work hard and build your capacity for hard work, and then also working on your efficiency and building your ability to utilize that energy. So number four, focus on breathing and posture during cardio training and riding. I mean, this drives me absolutely up the freaking wall. Like, cardio training starts with what? Breathing. Like, it's oxygen, right? It's your body's ability to, among other things, but like primarily is to deliver oxygen. I mean, your body can't live without oxygen, you know, for very long. So oxygen is what it's all about, and for your cardiovascular, not what it's all about, but it's one of the main things. But how we pay so little attention to breathing and posture during our cardio training. Like, there's so many people that can't even breathe properly. I did a blog post a little while ago called "The Best Cardio Workout You've Never Done." And, you know, unfortunately my prediction was right. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't one of my more popular ones, because it wasn't very exciting from the, like, hey, work your ass off doing this interval for this long and at this power rate and at this heart rate zone and blah, 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 blah. It was like, fix your breathing and fix your posture. But mainly fix your breathing and figure out how you can learn to control your breathing. And controlling your breathing is extremely important, because one, it's going to improve your ability to deliver oxygen and get rid of you know, the byproducts of the metabolism. And also it's going to help control your hormones and your arousal level, which I'll touch on here in just a second. But the thing is, make sure that your posture and your breathing are the focal point of your cardio training and your riding, and that you're not compromising your breathing patterns and your good posture to chase external numbers where it's like, man, I got to hit this power level, or I got to hit this heart rate. And it's like, you're, you know, already starting to lose it, and you push it even further because you got to hit this external number. Man, you're creating bad habits. Again, if you think about the efficiency side, the neuromuscular side, you're teaching your body that at these hard efforts to revert to inefficient postures and movement. And that's the last thing that you want to do. You want to make sure that your body only understands good breathing and posture, because when you're tired, it's going to revert to what you know. And so if it doesn't even know what bad breathing patterns and posture are like, then it's going to be less likely to start reverting to it. So it's again, this one just drives me nuts. Like, people work in their cardio training, but they don't understand how to breathe properly, and their posture is just crap on the bike when they're doing it, because your posture is a huge factor in your efficiency, both breathing and movement wise. So make sure you're focusing on that. All right, last thing, learn to control your arousal levels. And this is kind of a secret weapon that a lot of people don't really think about and take advantage of, but your arousal levels play a big role in your performance levels. So arousal levels are basically how hyped up are you, right? Like, so on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being like, you know, laying down ready to take a nap on the couch, and 10 being just freaking sparks flying out of your eyeballs and ears, just like, you know, you're just amped up as much as you can be. Now, there's an optimal arousal level for, you know, both in general and also for specific sports. So in general, you know, there's a reason that we have a level 10 arousal level, but we usually don't perform very well at that level 10 arousal level. It tends to interfere with motor control, and that's where you're getting big dumps of the adrenaline and cortisol and all of these hormones that they're great for short-term bursts of energy expenditure. But for us as mountain bikers, you know, we're not necessarily looking for that short term. You know, this is like your fight or flight. Like, man, my life is on the line and I either got to fight or I got to run like crazy. Like, that's that level. And so that's not where we want to be. So one, we don't want to be there in the gym, right? Like, if you're finding yourself having to just pop, you know, energy pills and caffeine or whatever, and just getting yourself hyped up, and for every workout, man, it's just a battle between you and the weights, bro. It's just, oh, dude, it's just it. You're teaching your body that when it's time to work, to just go to that level 10. And again, it's going to do what you're teaching it to do. And so if you're not on the trail, if that level 10 equals red line efforts and I'm about to blow up, you're actually trying to train your body to be comfortable with hard efforts without ever actually going to that level 10, if you can avoid it. And so in your training, you need to keep that in mind. Now, even within that, though, you know, if you're a downhill racer, you're going to have to learn how to have a higher arousal level at the beginning of your race than a cross-country racer or a guy who's getting ready for a 24-hour solo race. You know, like, you cannot show up to the starting line for a 24-hour solo race with the same arousal levels of a downhill racer and vice versa, because you're going to screw yourself from just an energy production standpoint, because your body's not going to be ready to deliver the energy at the levels and duration that you need. And a lot of that, again, just comes down to arousal levels. So you can train, you know, do all the cardio training you want, but if you don't understand how to control your arousal levels and you're showing up at the starting line, you know, with your heart rate already over like 160 and just like all these catabolic hormones already dumped in your bloodstream, and you're just like, you know, way too hyped for where you need to be, then it doesn't matter how fit you are, because your body's just going to be inefficient at using the energy and stuff. So, so learn to control those arousal levels. And, you know, without it, this is where sports psychology comes in. This is where things like meditation comes in, learning to control your self-talk. Also the environment. I mean, this is a huge thing. The more you can simulate your competitive environment, the more the body is going to be used to that, and the less kind of aroused it's going to get, the less threat that it's going to perceive from what it's expecting versus what it's experiencing. So, you know, this even goes to, like, you know, what time of day do you compete? Like, if you tend to race it at 2 o'clock on Saturdays, but your race pace hard rides are, you know, in the evenings on Wednesdays, well, there's going to be a disconnect there. Like, trying to have the times that you have your hard race pace rides coincide with the usual day and time that you race on is huge. And people don't think about this. Little things like that make a big difference, though, helping to control your arousal levels, because your body is just used to that work on that day at that time. And so, again, if it can predict the future and what it wants to do, and then that's what happens, there's much less energy going into that effort than if it's showing up and having to, like, figure out from scratch, like, holy shit, it's Saturday at 2 o'clock. Like, what's going on here? I'm not used to this. And, but yeah, so little things like that help. So that does it for my top five, biopower hacks. Again, if you, want to learn more, check me out at bikejames.com. I really appreciate, you know, everybody taking the time to listen to the presentation. And so, so that's it on the presentation. I'm going to actually go ahead and go back to the live thing here, and then, see if we got any questions. And if you guys want to, ask me any questions, I'll be open for it. So give me just a second here. And all right. Excellent. Cool. All right. All right. All right, I got a couple questions here. Okay, so again, if anybody has them, go ahead and type them in. I'm going to start at the bottom there. Mike says, cool, thanks. No problem. All right, Amy was having some problems getting in. I am not sure on that with the webinar stuff. Hopefully, we were able to get that figured out. Had some people helping her out there. All right. On here. Just going through a few of these guys. Just bear with me for a second. So apologize. It's always interesting when I come off and I've got quite a few things here. All right. Nick's got a question. Heart rate monitors to determine light and hard rides. Yes, heart rate monitors. Good question. I like to use heart rate monitors more for two basic reasons. One, to make sure that an easy day or an easy ride is really an easy ride. And so keeping the heart rate below like 150 is the goal on an easy ride. If you start getting the heart rate up much above that, you're starting to place metabolic stresses on the body that are starting to go beyond what we're looking for from a light standpoint. This is also a tip for you enduro racers. Like, honestly, wear a heart rate monitor between stages and make sure you keep that heart rate at below 150. And if you got to get off and walk, do it. But just avoid, letting that heart rate get above that 150 for sustained periods of time, because that is a metabolic cost for your body that you're not going to have for later on for your actual like stages. But as far as for hard rides, I prefer, again, use the heart rate monitors to have some data to look at and some trends. But when you're actually riding, it should be based on RPE, rate of perceived exertion, because again, you don't want to disconnect. When you race, what do you determine your pace on? Or do you have a heart rate monitor and you're looking at it saying like, oh, this is the pace I got to be at? No, you're like, one, you're pin, you know, following guy in front of you, or you're going based on how you feel, right? That's how you determine how hard you can go. And so if you're training and you're relying on an external number like power or heart rate meter to tell you how hard to go, and then you get into a race, and in that race you're trying to rely on your own rate of perceived exertion to tell you how hard to go, there's a disconnect there. Again, we get to those like expectancy versus what actually is happening for your brain. And if it's having to try and figure out, how to use RPE, then it's going to come at a higher metabolic cost than if you use the RPE all of the time and it just understands like, yeah, at a 170 heart rate, that's an RPE of this. This is what it feels like. So focus more on the feeling. It goes kind of what I talked about with the strength training stuff. But if you focus on the feeling more than the external number, then you're going to get much better transfer from your training to the actual event. So awesome. I hope that answers your question, Nick. And Nicholas, yeah, I can't really see the sidebar when I'm displaying the slides. So I might be able to figure out how one of these days, but I'm not that much of a wizard yet. All right. Excellent. Just going through a couple of these, cleaning them out. Oh, excuse me. Hit my little thing there. Number two was on my thing. I'm gonna email you a recap of everything. What was number two? Using your mountain bike for on bike cardio training, and also looking at standing pedaling as separate things. So just understanding your mountain bike's your best cardio training tool, and that that standing pedaling is separate than seated pedaling, and so you got to train them differently. So, but again, I'll send the replay link out so you can check that out. All right, everybody's helping each other out, man. I really appreciate you guys helping each other out, especially when I can't see the chat thing when I'm doing my thing. So excellent, Moro is on it. And all right, here we go. This looks like my slides were really a little confusing. Maybe the internet connection was a little slow getting some of it through. Here we go. Couple of thanks from Nicholas and Benjamin. No worries. So, do you have to separate cardio training from high intensity training from high intensity levels? Hari asked this question. That's I'm not sure exactly if I understand the question. I think what you're asking is Do we need to separate cardio training into different intensity levels? And you know, the answer is yes. Like, you need to understand kind of what higher intensity versus lower intensity cardio training methods are. But a lot of that too just has to do with you know, volume and intensity and stuff like that. So, for example, you know, there's definitely a place, like, you know, long slow distance, what's known as LSD, or you know, just, you know, that steady state cardio training, like, that gets a bad rap in a lot of circles. But the reality is if as long as you're keeping it low intensity, like you're keeping that heart rate like below 150, preferably below like 130 to 120, then what you're not stressing the body metabolically hard enough. So it's light, but you're giving the body a chance to just get better at pedaling efficiency and just being in that position and just feeling more comfortable with being on the bike. And so, but that's a little bit different result than the high intensity stuff. So if you're doing the high intensity intervals and hard rides and stuff like that, you know, those things are working more on the fitness side. Now you're pushing, you're stressing your body hard enough to where metabolically you're starting to put the stresses on it that your body will send the signals for it to start trying to improve the fitness levels and stuff like that. So yeah, so hopefully that answers your question. If it didn't, I apologize, and feel free to you know, post something, follow up there. So yes, Kim says, thanks for saving me from feeling pressure to ride a bro bike. Again, we are the only athletes in the world that are told to practice another sport to get better at your sport. You know what I mean? Like telling a mountain biker to go ride a road bike is a way to improve for their sport is like telling a baseball player to go learn to play golf and spend all off season swinging a golf club because it's swinging something at a white ball, right? It's really kind of ridiculous when you step back and outside of just tradition, when you step back and look at it from all of the perspectives of, like, that we know have from training, from, you know, neurological and energy systems wise and all of these different things, you start to realize that, like, man, that's, you know, the road bike is really not the great training tool. Now, that's not saying you can't get on the road. Now, if you live somewhere where you can't get on the trail, you can go on the road. But again, there's no law, at least that I'm aware of, that says that you have to ride a road bike on the road. You can ride a mountain bike on the road. If you don't want to tear up your knobbies, then, you know, get you some slicks. But even then, like, you know, get you some cheap, heavy knobbies. And we talked about that in efficiency training. You know, if you spend your off season pedaling a freaking, you know, semi tank around with knobbies on the pavement, and then you jump back on your mount, you know, on the trail when it's time to go, you're gonna feel like, again, like I said, like somebody took a boat anchor off the back of you, which is what you want, right? So yeah, don't buy a road bike for training. If you like road biking, that's great, but do not do it and think that it's training for mountain biking, because it's not. The arousal level during a hard ride, Julio wants to know, and the arousal level versus a hard effort. You know, again, this kind of it's a good question, but it's kind of specific, you know. So the arousal level for a downhill racer's hard ride is going to be different than the arousal level for a cross country racer's hard ride. And again, it's different for everyone too, because you may find some people that do better with a little bit higher or a little bit lower arousal level than what you would consider normal. But in general, like, you want to avoid showing up at the starting line with your heart rate already over like 150. Like, once your heart rate gets over 150, that starts to, one, there's metabolic cost being incurred and you're just standing there, you know, your body's having to, like, it already, you know, expending energy for while you're just standing there being nervous. And two, it affects your reaction rates and your ability to for fine motor control. And so, no matter who you are, I would say that that's a good general rule of thumb, is trying to make sure that your, whatever your arousal level is, that your heart rate is, you know, below 150 when you're getting ready to start. And again, it's kind of a little bit of a personal thing. I don't mean to, like, try and, like, you know, pass the question off, but you know, I know, like, for me, like, I'm a mellower dude, so my arousal level will be a little bit different for than someone who's a little bit more kind of amped up and intense about some things, where there's other things where I'm really amped up and intense, you know. And so it really just kind of depends. And it's that, again, that's where training comes in, and that's where the race-paced rides come in. And this is where, you know, you spending training, like, that's a great question. I don't know. I would say, like, again, if you're racing downhill, you know, it's got to be a little bit higher than cross country. I've already said that, but my point is that you want to try to use your training time to find these things out. You know, so if you go into a hard ride and observe yourself, you know, like, you know, if like, man, I just wasn't, you know, high energy today and I can feel it on the ride, you know, like I gotta, like, you know, work on getting a little bit better energy. Or, you know, I think a lot of this too boils down to, like, people, when they're asking, sorry about that. I am not used to dealing with headphones, and I'm having a tree taken down, and so I'm trying to spare everybody. The chainsaw is going on, so I've got this on, and I keep trying to knock it out of my ears. So anyway, sorry about that. But like I said, you want to use your training to answer those questions. Is ultimately the thing is you know, what's the right arousal level for you, and observing that stuff. And so so anyways, again, feel free to ask some follow up questions if that wasn't specific enough. But hopefully I was non-specific enough with that. Kevin asks, this is probably another webinar, but can you speak a bit about nutrition importance to feed all the systems you mentioned? And yeah, nutrition is extremely important, because if your body's not getting those raw materials that it needs, then it's not going to you know, be able to function properly. I would say my best thing to keep in mind here is you know, there's just two different ways of looking at this, like fat versus fuel, or fat for fuel versus carbs for fuel. And both can work. There's not a right or a wrong way necessarily to go about it. And what I mean, like, carbs for fuel is, like, are you relying on carbs as your energy source when you're riding, or are you relying on fat for as your energy source for riding? And so the you know, for downhill guys and stuff, it's a short, intense thing. It's definitely a higher carbohydrate. You know, a higher, you know, more of an anaerobic metabolism thing. So you're going to rely on that stuff more. But, you know, most people, our rides are, you know, longer than that. And so I think that most people would benefit from looking at trying to learn how to burn fat for fuel more for their events. And so, you know, I had a webinar not too long ago with Abel James, who does the Wild Diet. And I would refer to that. I think the Wild Diet does a great job of explaining to most people, if you're just a normal person, you know, looking to, you know, perform well, but you're not, like, again, when I say a pro athlete, like, if you're not paying your bills based on your performance, then, you know, I don't really think, you know, we use the term pretty pro pretty loosely in cycling. Like, most people are really, we're just amateurs, man, having fun. And so looking at longevity and stuff like that, but you know, trying to train your body to use fat for fuel so you're not relying on, like, goos and all of these crazy just sugar packets and stuff like that. And, you know, I'm sorry, but, like, even, like, natural sugar, like, people are all like, oh, Scratch Labs or other places. I just use them because they're one I hear a lot about. And they do have a good natural product, but it's, like, it's still sugar, you know. It's still just, like, dumping sugar into your system on a consistent basis. And that's not, you know, so that's one way to fuel the system. But I would encourage people to look at ways to try to get their body burning fat for fuel as a way to do it, especially for the enduro people, because, again, with the, you know, I keep touching on this on enduro, it keeps coming up. Maybe I do need to do just an enduro training webinar, but, you know, it's a long event, all day event. And you can only, again, from my understanding, for most places, you only have what you can pack, right? So you don't have, you can't, like, whatever you've got on you is what you have to eat that day. And so, learning to use fat for fuel so that you're not relying on a constant influx of carbs and sugar packets is extremely helpful if you find yourself in a position where, like, I can't have all those carbs and goo packets that my body's used to. So, but anyways, so hopefully that answers your question. Nelson, great webinar. Thanks, buddy. Couple questions. I have a double joint injury, so I'm a 2-3 ride, my injured leg tends to stop responding to the demand, bad coordination. Man, you know, I am not sure on that, Nelson. That sounds, man, that, I would say that you want to, one, make sure that you don't have some sort of neurological thing going on. So, I mean, you know, you want to check with your doctor and any, you know, professional that they might send you to make sure that you don't have something, you know, bigger going on. I mean, to just kind of have your leg kind of crap out and stop responding and working. That's not the muscles. That's your nervous system. Something's going on and your nervous system is not playing nice at that point. And so it's either trying to protect that leg for some reason, or it's getting some sort of weird signal that's telling it that it needs to try to protect it by shutting it down. I would say that's kind of beyond the scope of my expertise, but I wish I had something more more specific for you, but that would be my advice for that. So all right, so Dan Wynn, yes, all right, I got a couple others here. Matthew asks, James, how do I approach enduro training on local trails that are mostly XC? I'm worried I won't be able to practice my downhill skills enough. So again, this touches on there's a couple things going to making a great athlete, and genetics is part of it. You know, genetics ain't everything, but it's part of it. You know, if you're 5'4", you're probably gonna have a tough time playing in the NBA, right? Nothing you can do. Where your location. So, you know, if you're is another thing. I don't. The point is that if you're in a location that doesn't let you practice the sport exactly as the sport's supposed to be practiced, then yeah, you kind of got to make do with some other stuff. But you also just have to realize that one, you're a little bit of a handicap disadvantage. You just need to be honest with yourself about that. You know, like if you're trying to compete against people that have access to this stuff, you either need to one, move to where they are, or two, just make peace with the fact that they may have a little bit of an advantage on you there, and you may have to do some other things, you know, to get an advantage on them. But my point is that you just got to kind of deal with the cards that are dealt you and learn to be comfortable with them. Now, as far as like the cross country trail stuff goes, if you're talking about like downhill skills, I would say that, you know, I'm sure that there's probably sections of your trails that have some of the elements of what you need to practice. You know, sessioning sections of trail is a good way if you don't have like an extended trail system where you can, you know, hit different sections. You know, just if you have one good section and it's like, okay, I'm gonna freaking hit this, and then I'm gonna turn around and, you know, go easy, even if it's walking your bike back up, because we're trying to follow these principles of like, you know, hard effort with an active recovery, easy effort, and getting your body used to those demands. You know, the other thing that you can do is plan some specific trips to areas that have downhill riding and allow you to work specifically on your downhill skills for a short period of time. But those would be my top two pieces of advice if you live in an area that doesn't have like great opportunities for extended trails with lots of downhill stuff, what you might consider like an enduro trail. So yeah, hope that answers that. What to worry more in biological power with aging? You know, again, it all with aging is that's where the neuromuscular efficiency stuff with me is the most fascinating thing, because that is where your big gains lie with your aging athletes. Because like I said, nobody's VO2 max improves forever. And as we get older, it starts to decline. So the cardiovascular system stuff is important, but it's understanding that the cardiovascular system there is to support the muscles and the neuromuscular system. It's not the most, like, it doesn't, like, you know, you don't start breathing hard and then start moving. You start moving and then you start breathing hard, right? So your muscles start moving and doing their thing, and then the cardiovascular system kicks in to support that movement. And so, you know, just that's, so you need to just keep that movement efficiency top of mind first and foremost. Maintaining strength levels is extremely important with that as well, because strength is just neurological efficiency. Like, you know, how efficiently can you recruit the muscle fibers that you have and keep the ones that you don't want firing turned off? And, you know, it's a neurological efficiency thing is all strength is. So another reason why strength training helps with this stuff. So as you age, it's the neurological stuff is kind of becomes the focal point as far as like making sure that you're focusing on efficiency over just constantly trying to just add to the size of the gas tank through hard cardio training. All right. So got a couple people answering a few more questions here. Got some people saying thanks and Sign out. Let's see here. All right, says thanks, man. That was just what I needed to know. But also asking if off-season training means only doing low intensity, high volume riding, or can you do high intensity? No. You need to do high intensity training all the time. It's just it's a percentage thing, right? It's a continuum. It's not an either or. And so and this is where the race pace rides come in. They're very important. You can't, you know what I mean? Like this disconnect thing. It's all if you always remember that the point is to train your brain to see the things that you want it to see so that it becomes very comfortable with being able to predict what's going on and how to react. That is the huge factor in your overall biological power production. And so the if you're during your off season and you're just, you know, this is where the LSD gets a bad rap, because what will happen is people will spend these huge blocks of time only doing long, slow distance, high volumes of easy, low intensity cardio. And then they, you know, it comes time to like lay the hammer down, and they're not used to laying the hammer down. And their body's not used to doing it, and the metabolic demands and the movement demands and all those things. And so again, there's a disconnect all of a sudden between your body spent, you know, weeks or months getting used to this, and now all of a sudden you throw it into this disconnect. And so if you're not spending time in the off season, like preferably you're able to still get out and ride, and you're able to get out once or twice a week and go on the hard race pace rides. In the off season, I'd say, you know, more like once a week, early off season, ramping that up as the season gets closer. But that's preferable. If you're not able to do that, then that's where you need to have some hard cardio training sessions that mimic the energy system's demands. And you need to look at, again, the duration, the work to rest ratio of how you ride, and to help you determine like what's going to be a good cardio training program with that. But no, you got to have high intensity stuff in there all the time. It's just really the 80-20 split is what you're looking for. And this is, again, this will vary, you know, like in certain periods of time. You know, you want 80% low intensity, 20% high intensity. You know, there'll be periods during the off season where you may go to 90% low and 10% high. And but there's going to be times during the season or you know, late off season when you're getting ready to peak, where you may go to like, you know, 30% high intensity and 70% low. But throughout the average out over a training year, you're looking at about an 80 to 20 split of low intensity to high intensity training. And if you've got that, and again, that's where the skills training rides come in. Like if you're really focused on the skill side of it, and you're not focused on going fast and working hard, then those skills training rides that I talk about become, you know, a moderate to light intensity ride. And so again, that's the most important cardio training you can do. Riding your bike is the most important cardio training you can do. You should never compromise that to add in more off bike training stuff. You know, you don't want, you know, off bike training stuff to be interfering with your on bike training stuff. So yeah, no, you got to have it in there. It's just going to vary a little bit, that actual percentage, throughout the season. So cool, excellent. And then all right, so everybody's just saying thanks, man. Yeah, I appreciate you guys coming on, and it was a lot of fun doing it. Just wrapping up here, I got one more question here from Ivan I'm gonna get to. But yeah, everybody that said thanks, appreciate it. So Ivan, any tips on breathing? Again, the best thing I would tell you to do is go check out that blog post that I did at bikejames.com called the best cardio workout you've never done. And it's basically showing you crocodile breathing, which is a way to just kind of help reset the breathing and make sure you're breathing diaphragmatically. Because again, this goes back to the hormone and arousal thing, right? If you don't breathe properly, if you chest breathe, chest breathing triggers the fight or flight response. It'll actually change the metabolic you know, environment in your body versus diaphragmatic breathing. And so using the diaphragmatic breathing is extremely important. Learn how to drive your breathing from your diaphragm rather than your chest. Plus, when you're using your chest to breathe, you can't use your chest to move. And so you're going to increase your upper body stability and mobility and movement on the bike once you learn how to use the diaphragm properly. So the crocodile breathing, and then couple that with the Russian breathing ladders, and I think what Steve Maxwell called them. But they're basically a way to train your breathing where you start just walking, getting a pace, and then you breathe, you know, in on one step, out on one step. Then you go to in on two steps, out on two steps, and then in on three and out on three. You build up to 10, and you learn, you know, real quickly how to like vary your breathing based on different, you know, short and quick versus long and slow. And most people really start to struggle with the breathing ladders once they get to about 6 or 7. And if you do, if you can't get all the way up to like, you know, preferably you won't be able to get all the way up to 10 and it not feel hard. But, you know, if you're getting to 6 or 7 and all of a sudden you're really struggling with your breathing, being able to breathe in slow enough and deep enough and out slow enough and deep enough to be able to extend your breathing that long, you probably have some breathing dysfunctions that you want to address before you really start hammering like extra cardio training. Like you need to ride your bike. But like I would say for someone who struggles with that, that doing extra sprint intervals or spin training class or anything like that that's like extra off-bike cardio before you fix your breathing is actually working against you because you're just reinforcing bad breathing habits when you do that. And so fix your breathing habits first, and then you're continue to focus on your breathing and your posture, because again, your posture is a big thing. If I go like this, I can't breathe properly. Now I can't access all of my lungs. And so good posture drives good breathing, and good breathing will reinforce good posture. And so focusing on those two things as your limiting factor when you're doing your cardio training is extremely important. So again, don't focus on external numbers rather than your breathing and posture there. So hopefully that works. Tommy says, thanks. No problem, Tommy. Hari, good. Excellent. Thanks. Glad that answered that. And Mark, yeah, sorry you got on late, but yes, you will be getting the replay link sent to you just a few hours. So as soon as it posts, just takes a little bit, and then I'll send you guys the replay link for you to go back and watch it. So well, right on. So I think we got through all of the questions there. If anybody else has anything they want to throw out here last second, feel free to do it. Otherwise, I'm going to sign off. So again, really appreciate you guys taking the time to do this or to join me. Love getting the chance to answer your guys' questions and interact with you guys while I'm doing this, which is what makes the webinar so cool. And then just getting a chance to share the information. And I'm glad the slides worked. I was so worried that I was going to turn off the slides and come back and just see a bunch of comments going like, oh, the slides didn't work again. So small victories. We'll take them, right? So, all right. Well, once again, it's been James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems. And Mark says, thanks, man. Dude, no worries, brother. It was my pleasure. And we'll keep the PowerPoint. I'll get that out to you guys as well. So, anyways, once again, James Wilson, MTB Strength Training Systems. Check me out on the web at bikejames.com. And I'll talk to you guys in the next webinar.